Chapter 29. Jim. Muskrat paddled her legs like she was swimming as she floated down the corridor outside the galley. Her bark was deep and conversational, and she had a wide canine grin. At the end of the corridor, Zan went still for a split second before letting loose a peal of laughter and opening his arms to catch the floating dog. "You can do it," Teresa Duarte said, clapping her hands. "She won't bite me?" Zan called back. "She's a good dog. She doesn't bite." The excitement on the black-eyed boy's face was bright. He put out his hands, gray fingers splayed, and chortled with delight. Jim slipped past him, ducked under the floating dog, and pulled himself into the galley proper. Alex and Fires were already there. Alex, held to the floor by magnetic boots, and Fires on the float, but steadied on a handhold.
"Looks like they're having fun," Jim said as the Rosinante decanted fresh coffee into a bulb. "What exactly are they doing?"
"They're playing catch," Alex said, "with the dog."
Jim sipped the bitter, lovely coffee, feeling the familiar warmth against his palate and down his throat.
"Of course they are. I don't even know why I asked."
Reconfiguring the Falcon's lab for a dual dive wasn't trivial, and it wasn't fast. Elvie had packed enough supplies in the Falcon for anything and everything to break, so getting her hands on another set of sensors, a second medical couch, and enough backup monitoring units was simply a matter of figuring out which crate in which cargo hold. They couldn't move the walls of the lab, though, and finding the space for all the equipment and the technical staff was taking time, and an apparently endless number of meetings. Added to that were the baseline scans for Amos, integrating the data from the Rosie's medical bay, and a series of long, in-depth interviews with Elvie intended to map the previous explorations of the library to the shifts in consciousness and knowledge that the mechanic had suffered. As the days moved on, more new faces started appearing on the Rosie. First, it was Fires and Elvie, but as her time became more and more in demand, Fires started coming over alone. Then bringing Kara and Zan with him, or more often, just Zan. Outside the galley, Muskrat woofed happily as she drifted past the galley's door, heading back toward Teresa.
"Kids are getting along well," Fires said. "You're just testing Teresa up as a babysitter, aren't you?" Alex asked. "I mean, she's old enough."
"Zan's twice her age, easy," Fires said.
"He's a kid, though," Alex said. "It's just, he's been a kid for a really long time."
"What do you do when the models fail?" Fires said, spreading his hands. "Zan and Kara don't really exist on the kid-not-kid spectrum. They're just Kara and Zan."
Teresa's laughter boiled in from the corridor. Even with the months she'd spent on the Rosie, it was an unfamiliar sound, harsh and joyous. Jim didn't think of Teresa Duarte as the laughing type. But maybe it was just that she didn't often have the opportunity for it. There weren't very many people who could see past her circumstances to the girl she actually was. Jim wasn't sure he could, even. She was the daughter of the God Emperor, their human shield, and heir to Laconia, and its highest-ranking apostate. All that was true, but it wasn't complete. There was a kid there, too, one who'd lost her mother and her dad, who'd run away from home, who needed things emotionally that Jim could guess at, but he didn't know. He was probably just as much a cipher to her. There was something weirdly universal about her laughter, though, and Zan's, the sound of young humans at play. Jim realized they were being quiet, all three of them, and listening to the kids like it was a piece of music. Muskrat whined once, a high, nervous sound, and Teresa called for Zan to stop. A moment later, her face appeared at the door, flushed and sweaty. "Hey, Muskrat needs to use the little dog's room. Can I take Zan down to the machine shop so we can see how it works?" Jim's reflexive, "Sure, go ahead," stumbled over the idea of Zan and Teresa alone in the ship. It wasn't that he thought they'd do anything malicious. It turned out he trusted Teresa more than that. But in their present moods, something could happen by mistake. The machine shop of an aging Martian gunship wasn't a great place for oopsies.
"I'll come too,"
Alex said, and tossed the last of his meal into the recycler. Jim turned to Teresa, pointed his thumb at Alex, and said, "Don't let him start playing with the tools." The girl rolled her eyes, seeing through Jim's weak joke to the concerns behind it and dismissing them out of hand. Alex clapped his shoulder on the way out, and Jim drank more of his coffee as the girl and boy and dog and man muttered and chuckled their way to the lift shaft and then down.
"Thank you," Fias said.
"You're welcome."
"For what?"
"Letting Zan come get a little time away from the pressure cooker. He puts a good face on everything we're doing, but it's hard for him. Every time Kara goes in, I think he worries about how much of her is coming back."
"Is that a problem?"
"I don't know. Maybe. We're not in territory with much precedent. We'll pretty much know there's a massive change coming when it's already happened."
"I know the feeling," Jim said.
He finished his coffee and tossed the bulb away.
"Thanks for letting me come over here, too. The Falcon's a fine ship, and the company's generally not the worst, but after a few months on the float, I do start fantasizing about long walks by rivers and university coffee shops."
Jim laughed politely, but there was a tightness in his chest. He keyed in a simple breakfast of eggs and beans.
"I am sorry about that."
"About what?"
Fias asked.
"Sticking you here. You and Elvie. I mean, I did kind of fuck you two over by getting you the job."
Fias tilted his head. Jim had known him since Illis, and the years lay gently on the man. His hair was still thick and darker than it probably had a right to be. The lines in his face mostly gave evidence of laughter. Now, he only looked thoughtful.
"I know why we're here. If anything, we should thank you for the opportunity."
"Okay, now you're bullshitting me."
Fayez was quiet for a long moment. Then,
"You have a minute? I want to show you something."
Jim shrugged, paused the meal, and followed as the other man led the way to the lift shaft, then to the airlock and into the Falcon. The weird astringent smell was still there, but it wasn't as assaulting now as the first time he'd smelled it. Familiarity had numbed him. Fires turned down a long hallway, heading down toward the ship's reactor and drive decks. It was eerie seeing the same Martian design language that had built the Rosinante grown and complicated into the Laconian flesh of the Falcon. It reminded Jim of a documentary he'd seen about parasitic fungi that took over ants. Here was a ship that had been Martian, that became infected by the protomolecule and the ambitions of Winston Duarte, and now it looked similar and acted similar, and you could almost mistake it for the kind of ship that the Rossi still was. But this was something else.
"You know, we keep Zan isolated when Kara goes on her dives, right?"
"I do," Jim said.
"The idea is that he'd just be an extra variable, another influence we'd have to correct for. But he's also the control group. We see how Kara changes and how he doesn't. And maybe that tells us something we need to know."
A dark-haired woman with her attention on a hand terminal drifted into the corridor in front of them. When she glanced up and saw Jim, a glimmer of panic came into her eye. He nodded as they passed. That makes sense to me, Jim said. And when we're not doing that, we use the same rig to isolate the catalyst. It's a lot like Illus. You had a sample of the protomolecule on your ship, and it was accessing all the artifacts on Illus, flipping switches, seeing what came on, looking to report that the ring gate was built. Which it never did, because there was no one to report to. Well, we have a sample here, and Cortázar figured out how to loop it back onto itself so that our artifact only comes on when we want it to. Clean and easy, right? Sounds like it. Fáez glanced back at him, and the laughter and humor were gone. This is where we keep the sample, the catalyst. Come take a look. The cabin was small and Spartan. A satchel was fixed to the wall with a tablet just visible at the edge. The only other thing reminded Jim of the kind of pressurization chamber used on Earth when someone had come up from scuba diving too quickly, or else a crematory furnace. It was a little over 2 meters long, with a hatch at the end. A screen set into the box was dark. Fires tapped it, and it came to life. There was a woman on the screen. Her eyes were open. They glowed with a subtle blue light, and they focused on nothing. Jim understood, and it felt like a punch to the chest. This is the catalyst? I looked her up, Fires said. I didn't tell Elvi. Back in the day, this was Francisca Torres. She worked in the science directorate as a technician. I assume Cortázar knew her, at least in passing. She was going through something. Maybe her love life sucked. Maybe she always wanted to be a dancer and realized it wasn't happening for her. Anyway, she started drinking and showing up to work intoxicated and belligerent. She didn't even go home that day. Uchida had a streamlined disciplinary hearing with Cortázar and the head of security, and they put her in the pen before she even sobered up. Jim looked at the face. It was smooth, but not like she was young, like she was swollen. The woman, the catalyst, Francisca, opened her mouth as if she were about to speak, then closed her lips again. For about 5 years before Duarte tracked Elvi down and brought her to Laconia, at your suggestion, granted, this woman was being eaten by the protomolecule. And she still is. We keep it in check so that it's not growing free the way it did, but we don't feed her. We don't cut her hair. She doesn't take bathroom breaks. She doesn't sleep. Every now and then, we hit the chamber with a couple of hours of hard radiation. That's it. She isn't human in any meaningful way. Not anymore. She's a skin balloon filled with protomolecule. Jim tried to catch his breath. I'm not going to bullshit you, Fires continued. If we took what we do here to a normal ethics board, they just call the police. We've moved past scientific ethics, past moral questions, and I'm pretty sure we're shooting past crimes against humanity now. But I still know it could be even worse. Jim nodded. I understand. No offense, but you fucking don't, Fáez said. I don't want to be the one doing this. I really don't want Elvi to be the one doing it. But more than anything else, I don't want Cortázar or Uchida to be here. The men who looked at Francisca Torres and thought this was a good thing to do with her, I don't want them in charge. If this was their lab, Zan wouldn't be over with his new friend Teresa laughing at a dog pooping into partial vacuum. He'd be in a box, like he was when we found him.
They'd haul him out when they wanted to do something to him, and they'd put him back when they were done, just like they were fitting a screwdriver back in a toolbox. So, yeah, you fucked me and mine over, and we've done shit here that the gods will never forgive us for. But when you're feeling bad about it, remember that the alternative was somehow even worse. Jim was still thinking about it 3 days later when the lab was ready. It looked like a mess. Cables snaked along the walls and floor, tied in place with bits of wire and binding tape. The second medical couch, the one for Amos, was canted at 30 degrees to make space for the sensor arrays that were hooked into it. What had been a perfectly organized, clean, clear, overly designed space looked like Jim's bedroom before he'd gone into the Navy, only with less laundry on the floor. The voices of the Laconian team were tight and high. No one looked at him, and for the first time since the Rosie had docked to the Falcon, he felt like being ignored came easy. When they did take note of him, the sense was more annoyance that he was in the way than anything else. "If you feel uncomfortable," Elvie was saying. "I'm fine," Kara answered. She was in a tight-fitting medical slip that kept her warm, held the contact sensors in place, and made a fine mesh matrix for the scans that would be going through her as soon as the dive began. She looked like someone in a swimming competition, the same hard, athletic focus. "I want this. I'm ready for it." He thought there was a shift in Elvie's expression, but he didn't know what it signified. Harshan Lee, Elvie's second-in-command, was strapping Amos into the other medical bed. The big man was in a suit that matched Kara's, but where the girl was focus and determination, he was smiling at the absurdity of it all. The black eyes caught Jim's, and Amos lifted his chin.
"Hey, Captain. You come to see the show?"
"I'm not sure how much there's going to be for me to look at."
"I do like the outfit," Amos said. "Very flattering."
"If you don't want to do this, you just have to say the word. You know that, right?" Jim said. "Please don't move," Dr. Lee said. "I'm trying to get the sensor baselined."
"Sorry,"
Amos said, then turned back to Jim.
"You don't have to worry about me. This is what I came here for."
"Wait, really? Please lie flat against the medical couch," Dr. Lee said. Amos gave a cheerful thumbs up and shifted as he'd been told. Jim pushed back, letting himself float away against the wall. At the door to the hallway, Naomi floated in. Her hair was pulled back and she was scowling, but she softened when she saw him. Dr. Lee's voice was sharp and loud.
"Final checks, all. Final checks."
The activity in the room didn't speed up or slow down, but it changed. Jim found a handhold and steadied himself with it. Elvie floated beside him.
"You ready for this?"
Jim asked. "I just hope it works. If we did all this for basically nothing, well, that'll suck."
"Final checks are in and green," Dr. Lee announced. "We are good to proceed on the lead researcher's instruction."
He looked over at Elvie. She nodded.
"We are good to proceed," Lee said.
And Jim thought there was a satisfaction in his voice.
"Please transfer the catalyst now."
On the medical couches, Kara relaxed, and Amos closed his eyes. Interlude. The Dreamers. The Dreamers dream, and their dream carries them up into the familiar vastness. The swell and the flow and the minds that are empty, because the light between them is the thought that they think together. The grandmothers beckon with fingers that never knew a hand. "Look, look, look, and then see." And she spins and she sparkles, but he doesn't.
He holds firm as a stone in the stream, as a shadow in the light, as a thing. He stops, and by stopping, reminds. They are threefold, and that mattered once. But the grandmothers fall giggling on into themselves and through as they send seed after seed after seed into the airless wind. And some immeasurably few set root and grow back to them. Here is how we built it all. And here is how it fed us. And here is what love meant when love meant nothing. And she broadens and thins, and she falls into it. But he stands still. She can feel the want in him as rich as in her. But she feels the thing that stands against the wanting, and it reminds her. They are threefold, and the dream shudders like an image projected onto cloth when a wind blows. The grandmothers are dead. Their voices are all songs sung by ghosts, and the truths they tell, they would tell to anyone. They cannot listen back, and the dreamer sees the hollow behind the mask. She tries to turn her head to look behind her, to see the single living man in the land of the dead, and the gesture goes on forever. The essence of turning and turning and turning without the release of having turned. The dream falls thread from thread, and he is there. Blue fireflies and black spirals. Weariness radiates from him, and she sees the flesh thin against his bones, weak and frail as God himself in the birth pain of creation. And he turns to her and them. She isn't synced with the BFE, floats behind her. We're seeing the wormhole activity in the artifact falling off, but she's going strong. And same for subject two. Anyone know what we're looking at here? The soft, weary eyes find her, and find him, and find them. The dreamer tries to wake, but the other one folds into themselves like he's hiding something against his black scarred breast. Keep them going, Dr. Okoye says. And the third man hears her through their ears, and he smiles and lowers his bull, broad, vast, and timeless head. No trouble unless there's trouble, the dreamer wordlessly says. And then there's a lot of trouble. It was an unwinnable war, the third man says, but it was fought. They were soldiers made of crepe paper and candy floss, scattered by their own guns. But they made guns. They were cobwebs who stood against a rock slide and for all their cleverness were torn. The dreamer sees and is blind. Fuck, Dr. Okoye says, and the third man turns to her. I would have reached out to you if you could help me. But even these broken vessels, glorious as they are, can't support the work now. My work. Okay, all right, what do you mean, my work? What is an empire, but all humanity under the direction of a single mind? I was right, but I dreamed too small. I have seen how much more we have to be. Not following you. The horned god breathes out blue fires that live and die in an instant that is an eon. There are tools at our disposal, Dr. Okoye. Tools meant to fight against the enemy on the third side of the gates. I am learning about that. I have made some progress. It is a war we can win, but not without some changes. I'm hearing you say that you're responsible for stopping the conscious blinks and the changes to basic physics that the Ringgate entities were doing. Is that right? We aren't stronger than they were, but we're base materials. We are made from clay, and that's our power. They were fragile, and we are robust. They had a sword, but lacked the strength to wield it. I will find the sword and the map they left behind. I'm getting lost here. A sword? They built, but were unable to effectively use certain tools that prevent the enemy from intruding into what we mean when we say the universe. But those tools exist, and I believe we can make effective use of them. I think I understood that. In broad strokes, anyway. In order to fully access these tools, we have to become more like them. We have to be one thing, instead of billions of different ones. I am learning how to do that as well. Are you saying we need to become a hive mind? Yes, interconnected, with all our thoughts and memories flowing freely between nodes, all our illusions of division washed away. Empire was the closest I could imagine to it. But, the third man gestures at himself, almost in apology, I can imagine more now. It's all right. We'll be safe. Will we be people? We'll be better. And with a blue-black swirl of breath, he blows out the light of mind and is elsewhere. All right, I need all the sensor data. From the Falcon, from the BFE, the Ring Gate, everything. Put it all in the system. I need to understand what just happened, and I need to do it now. Another voice. A different voice. How strange to have different voices. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard the lead researcher. By the numbers now. This is no time to get sloppy. The dreamers opened their eyes, and nothing changes.